This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one.
Back with Libby Znaimer right after the news. Jane Brown is in for Libby. She is joined by the Medical Record Panel. The state of Canada's public health care system and Health Canada approves a weight loss drug for treating obstructive sleep apnea in adults with obesity. Together, Jane and the panel explore these issues and more. Later in the show, an update on the Ford government's plans for expansion of Billy Bishop Airport and revisiting the contentious High Park movement strategy. As always, we want you to get in on the action, so get in line now by calling one of ours, 416-360-0740, or toll-free, 1-866-744-7440. It is a big one for Canada at the World Cup as the Canadians play their final group stage match against Switzerland today. Regardless of the outcome, Canada will advance to the knockout stage for the first time, with a win or a draw guaranteeing a first-place finish in Group B and a better draw in the round of 32. Matches slated for 3 o'clock Eastern today at BC Place in Vancouver. Zoomer Radio weather, a mix of sun and cloud for your Wednesday, June 24th, a high of 25 degrees. Mostly cloudy tonight with a chance of showers, a low of 15. And tomorrow, clouds and showers, the risk of a thunderstorm, a high of 19. Right now it is 23 degrees Celsius in Toronto, 74 Fahrenheit, with the Humidex value feeling more like 25. I'm Jeremy Logan, and you're listening to Zoomer Radio.
Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby returns in a couple of weeks. She's taking some time to enjoy a special trip with her husband, Doug, which I'm sure she will tell you about when she is back. I'd like to get the phones ringing right off the top of Fight Back today by asking you, our Zoomer Radio listeners, if you've had orthopedic surgery or if you are waiting on a hip or knee replacement, and how it went or how it's going. Numbers to call, 416-360-0740 or 1-866-744-740. You can always text us if you'd like at 866-744-740. The conversation I want to get going is prompted by an editorial in the Globe and Mail by Dr. Brian Goldman. He's an ER physician and is the author of a book called The Casino Shift, Stories from an ER on the Edge. And in his editorial, Dr. Goldman talks about the crisis in our public healthcare system, specifically around public and private orthopedic surgery, and how the solution to this crisis just might be happening in Germany.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
Our medical record panelists are Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Center, Dr. Elisa Naiman, family doctor practicing in Toronto, and Dr. Barry Pacus, professor at the University of Toronto's Dalla Lana School of Public Health and former medical officer of health for York Region. Welcome, doctors.
Thank you.
Dr. Moore, I will start with you. You brought this editorial to our attention, so maybe it's best if you give us a synopsis.
Well, you know, Brian Goldman is a highly respected author and radio host of White Coat, Black Arts. And so I think when he speaks on healthcare issues, you know, his words have impact. And I think to me, this is the clearest he's come out to say, look, we have a major problem and we need to more seriously look at a mixture of private and public pay. And I have to say, I 100% agree with him. I mean, the reality is that every other developed country in the world has a public health system intermixed with a private system. In general, most of those systems, honestly, work better than ours does. and provide public care for less money than we're spending. And I think it's the reality is that the demand for healthcare with an aging population and a growth in the number of new drugs, new technologies that are needed, outstrips the ability of the government to pay for it. And so we have a situation where the only way of coping is by restricting access, whether it's access to joint replacements, whether it's access to emergency departments. The reality is that our healthcare system is not performing the way it should. And I think that there are ways of incorporating private care within a public system without compromising the basic principles of the Canada Health Act and without compromising the quality of the public system. And I think what Brian is saying is what's happening now is kind of private pay is sneaking into different areas. We need to have an intelligent adult discussion about how best we incorporate private pay, and trying to cut somebody down every time they try to suggest that we need to think about this is not the way forward.
Ultimately, the public and private care, though, should be the same, right, in terms of how long you wait, the quality of care you get. I mean, this is the foundation of Canada and how we feel about socialized health care, that everybody, regardless of income and financial status, should have the same access to health care.
Well,
Dr. Moore, yeah.
In theory, that would be great if we actually had access to healthcare. So what we have presently is a system where nobody has good access to healthcare. And so if you want an MRI, I'm actually waiting for an MRI because of a back problem. You know, I've had to wait months for an MRI. I called one of the MRI centers and said, look, I'm willing to pay for this. The government doesn't have to pay for it. And they said, we can only allow you to pay for it if you don't live in Ontario. Well, where's the sense in that? So the only way I can get an MRI scan, there's capacity here. The only way I can pay for it is to go to Alberta or Quebec to get it done. And if somebody from Quebec or Alberta wants an MRI scan, they have to come to Ontario to get it done. So how is a system that actually penalizes people for accessing healthcare, how can that be healthy? And the reality is, and this is an analogy somebody used with me, it's a bit like the 407, right? If I want to drive from Caledon to Peterborough, I can choose to drive on the 401, or I can choose to pay money and drive on the 407, and I'll get there faster. But by me driving on the 407, the 401 actually works better because there are less cars on the 401. And I think you could think about the same analogy in healthcare. If we allow people, if we expand capacity by funding it through private pay, actually everybody will be everyone will benefit.
Wow, if Dr. Malcolm Moore has to wait weeks and weeks for an MRI, that I think that really drives home your point. Dr. Goldman's assessment and whether it's feasible to apply some of what's working well in Germany to Ontario or Canada as a whole is a question, because he does talk about how well this hybrid system works in Germany. Dr. Naiman, would you like to comment on that?
I don't know the specifics about how the healthcare system works in Germany. But I will say that one of the things that he does discuss is that there is a supply of physicians, and that you need physicians to be working and you need to be training physicians so that there is always a supply, because you can't work within the private system in Germany, specifically related to this orthopedic example, until you've been working for at least 3 years. The problem here is we just do not have the supply. There is not enough physicians to be able to work for that to occur. And at the same time, there's people who are trained who actually can't get positions within the hospital setting because there's not the budget for them to be able to operate. So we're stuck in a catch-22 in terms of how we're going to proceed within the Canadian model. I would agree with Dr. Moore and say that our system does not work well. And I think with the baby boomer population increasing, there is an increasing request that I receive almost on a weekly basis for patients to be able to pay, to be able to have access to me on a faster basis, to have longer appointments, and for basically when they want to have care for them, for me to be able to provide it, and I'm not able to do that because it's not legal. Mm-hmm. But also within how our system works, I can't provide the care that people want because I am seeing and have a roster size of probably close to 1,400 patients, and people are looking for care. And from within a primary care example, there's many clinics and companies that are popping up, especially within Toronto, where you can pay $4,000 to $6,000 a year, and you will have one physician who is responsible for your care, and they are seeing 150 patients. And so with how the system works now, care is being compromised, and I can't spend the time with people how I'd like. And I agree with people when they say, well, I need to have more care and faster care when I want it and I don't want to wait. And I acknowledge that, but I say I work within a system that the system is fundamentally does not work well. And that Dr. Morris says that he can't get an MRI so quickly, to be honest, I'm surprised, because there is a system that even within our public system, that it's who you know and how you can get appointments. Mm. And people think this doesn't exist, but I will tell you, it's all who you know. And the wealthier you are and the better connections you have, you are able to have things facilitated in a much faster manner within the public system than people let on or discuss.
Well, and wouldn't that be a reason not to go down the road of more private health care because of the whole who you know and how much you're willing to pay? Dr. Pekas, you've read the editorial that we're talking about in the Globe and Mail by Dr. Brian Goldman. What are your thoughts on how he's assessing the situation and how we should go forward?
So, you know, I think there's no question that I'm not going to say our system isn't working because we do not have a system in Ontario, right? There is no system that connects the pieces. We just have one payer. And I think it's so bad and difficult right now that introducing some form of structured private care is what the governments and successive governments, not just the most recent one, have had in their sights because, you know, the government just cannot pay for the amount of healthcare necessary. However, I do disagree on one major point, although I think we probably do agree on this really, because the analogy Dr. Moore used, you cannot pretend like you can keep care for people who are not paying the same as the care for the people who are paying. That just doesn't make sense. If you pay for the 407, then you will get there faster. It is a better experience. And also someone had to pay to build the 407, not to overuse that example. So, you know, if we are willing to give that up and to have people who can pay getting more, faster, better services, and saving their lives in a more predictable way than others. You know, we have said in Canada, if you're wealthier, you can have a nicer car and you can have a nicer home. But the one thing you're not going to have is more of a chance of surviving a serious illness. You know, I think that pretending that it's still going to maintain an equitable situation is just not true. And no country in the world, not Germany and not Australia, not Israel or the UK, finds that's the case. And I'm very familiar with systems in other parts of the world, and many, many people do pay for, you know, either a small amount of additional services or a significant amount. How much more they get for that amount certainly differs. But, you know, the idea that we can get, just by making things more efficient, we can get the same service for everyone, it just doesn't make sense. Like, that's just not true. And we have to make a decision as a society which way we're headed. Mm-hmm. And I think our hand is being forced a little bit, and that's fine. But let's not pretend that it's still going to be as equitable as it is now.
Right. And what you've just said, I think, should prompt some phone calls from our Zoomer radio listeners. And some of you are on hold here. I'll get to you in just a second about your own journeys with hip and knee replacements. But what is the direction we should go? Should people with money have better access to health care? Because that's effectively what we're talking about here. How do we ensure that a person who doesn't have money gets the same access to health care, that their life could be saved or important surgery could be done in a timely manner going forward? Because we've just rested on a system that is at a crisis. And I think we're hearing it over and over in similar conversations. 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. You can also text us at 866-744-740. Jerry and Markham, what's your story?
Well, good afternoon, Jane. And my personal story is that 2.5 years ago, I had my hip replaced at North York General, and it's been a godsend.
Well, that is very good news. What were you living with? How was your life prior to the surgery?
Very painful, nagging, irritating. Really, really troubling pain. According to my surgeon's remark, Jerry, I think you kicked a few field goals too many.
So, Jerry, you first went to your family doc, and then tell us about the appointments and the timeline to having your surgery.
Well, I would say it took somewhere between 5 and 6 months to be queued up over at North York General. And the level of care was outstanding. I mean, they have an orthopedic wing within the hospital, and everyone's kind of recovering at the same rate and looking positively towards the future and so on. But truthfully, my pelvis was in pretty bad shape. Mm. I saw the befores and afters, and it's kind of ominous to see this thing that's inside of your body that you couldn't have expected what it looks like. But I don't care what it looks like. It works great, and I'm happy to say that people that I know have gone through the same procedure and are really, really enthused about how their lives have improved in the process.
And these are all public care surgeries?
Yes, of course.
Okay. And so was that acceptable to you, waiting 5 or 6 months?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I'd been in pain for years, and it became an escalated situation when I had a fall at home. And all of a sudden, I found myself in a situation where the pain just got to be a little too much. Mm-hmm. And the painkillers, well, they're problematic too, as your doctors will, agree with. The bottom line is that you have to be patient to a degree, because it is a service that's available to all Ontarians, not just the wealthy ones. And quite honestly, I highly recommend the procedure if someone is being asked whether they would consider that improvement in their lives.
Okay, Jerry, thank you very much for sharing, and we'll get to our other calls here in just a moment. Dr. Moore, your reaction to Jerry, who is pro-public, he was okay with waiting 5 or 6 months. I don't know if that's the norm or not. Maybe Dr. Naiman knows more about that, but I'll get your comment first, Dr. Moore.
Well, just, I think Barry and I fundamentally agree here, but I think he's right. if you allow private pay, first of all, when you're talking about private pay, you're not talking about restricting access for emergency or acute services, basic cancer services, cardiac, etc. That has to remain, you know, urgent care has to be urgent care for everybody. But if we just look at hips for an example, if the average waiting time for a hip is, let's say, you've got to wait to get an appointment before you go on the waiting list for the actual surgery. So let's say it's 9 months. Well, that sounds okay unless you actually have a hip problem like I do. Then that's no fun at all. And the second thing is, if let's say, just for the sake of argument, the province funds 20,000 hip replacements a year. That's why there's a waiting list, because the demand is 25. Well, what if 5,000 of those people pay to get it done privately? I agree with Barry. Those people will get it done sooner. But the reality is that if the government continues to fund 20,000 hip replacements, the people on the public list will also get it done sooner. They may not get it done as quickly as someone like myself or Barry, who's able to pay for it, but it'll be better than the current state. What we're doing with the current state is saying it absolutely has to be equal for everybody. So it's going to be equally terrible for everybody. What we should be talking about is, how do we make it better for everybody? And how does bringing in the investment from private pay allow the overall health system to be more robust?
Well, let me bring up this point then. I think we, you know, if we are going to go down this path, Dr. Naiman, the government, i.e. the taxpayers, should not be funding private hospitals to allow those people with money to, in essence, be subsidized so that they can get faster and potentially better care. Like, they have to be completely separate. The private system cannot be funded by the people of Ontario or the people of Canada.
So I think, so especially with hip and knee replacements, as the technology has improved, there's minimal stay. You could be going home actually the day of your procedure and going home. And so then there's just the cost of the operatory and the healthcare workers, and the system that would be in place in terms of post-care management. But I think that there is a desire and a move that people would be happy with a private facility that's strictly private, where people could go and have this done. Now, when we talk about the 5 to 6 months, he's probably right in saying that his wait was 6 months for his hip replacement. But there's more complexity to that, because I don't think there's just a general wait time. Some people want specific doctors, so that will change your wait time. Some people want a specific approach that's done for your hip replacement. Do you want it done the old way, where it's more of a lateral approach, or do you want it done where it's more anterior and there's as a newer procedure where the recovery potentially is better? So people will inquire about a specific type of doctor who does it in a certain way. People will inquire about a hospital that they want to have. There's no central process for this to be done. And then people will say, well, I want you to send the referral to a couple of places. Well, I can't really do that because it's an administrative burden. And also it's just adding complexity to a system that doesn't function well. And so this talk about the wait time, how can we improve the wait, is actually much more complex than just that. Mm-hmm. And then you haven't even talked about post-op care. The government will fund a certain amount of physiotherapy right. Post-op for your hip or your knee replacement. But what you get from the government is not what you're going to get if you pay for it. And physiotherapy is a perfect example. If you're over 65, if you're under 18 or 19, if you're on ODSP, you get access to OHIP-funded physiotherapy within the province. The amount of care that you get is actually probably useless, to be honest. You get maybe 4-6 sessions. The government just either freezes the amount of you that you get, and so it's hard for a clinic to exist, so they just cut the number of visits you get. You get one visit, like you get one body part at a time. You can go back, and the wait list for physiotherapy and OHIP funded is very long. And to be honest, the care that you get does not compare at all to the care that you're going to get in a private physiotherapy clinic, where you're spending over $100, $150 for a 45, 60-minute session.
Right. And so it's a totally different dynamic too. Having had a fractured hip and a few sessions in public physiotherapy versus private physiotherapy, it's a whole different environment. I think the care that you're getting is just as good, but crowded waiting rooms, crowded rooms where you're having the physio, it feels very different, the public versus the private. Let's go to Tom in Ancaster. Tom, you had surgery, back surgery.
Yes, I did in October. And I want to say, actually, my experience was really good. Getting there was the problem, really. You start with MRIs back over a year or two ago were so difficult to get. And my problem was I had severe back pain that came into sciatic. So I would walk and 10 minutes later, the pain would start in my backside all the way down to my calf, and I couldn't walk. And the pain was, it was really bad news. So anyways, I've been treated for sciatic with physical therapists, and everybody realized, there's something wrong. So we really need an MRI. So that became a problem because when the referrals go out, the doctor writes lumbar problem because they don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And they don't really know the severity of what the pain is because nobody can measure pain, right?
Right.
So they don't know if you're having minor pain or serious pain. In my case, I could barely walk. I could barely bend and everything. And it came that my disc between the vertebrae L4 and L5 was a bulging disc, but not outwards, inwards, where it was hitting on the main nerve coming down from my back.
Gotcha. And just in the interest of time, Tom, because we are running out of it, how long from deciding you needed an MRI to the back surgery, how long was that time?
Well, the MRI, I had to end up going to Buffalo because it was like 6 months to 8 months to get one. And I was in, I was having that problem. So what happens, I got the MRI, I realized what it was. The spinal cord was being narrowed and the nerve was being hit. Then we knew what it was. Then I got help through a pain clinic because they sent me for evaluation and they were giving me shots on the back. And then I chased down the referral for the orthopedic spine surgery at St. Michael's. And once I saw them, bang.
Okay.
They were getting it in. And I'll tell you quickly, operation success, 8 months. I got a personal trainer and I'm doing my work to get back to as close to normal as I was before.
Oh, that's a great news, Tom. Thank you so much for sharing. Dr. Pekus, final comment from you, just along those lines, like in terms of the priorities of the government, make it a good public system and take funding, take money out of other areas to ensure it stays strong or doesn't continue to falter.
Listen, healthcare is now costing at least two or three times what it did when Medicare was set up. So I understand the previous caller's passion for healthcare, and I have that as well. Nobody can be more in favor of equitable and universal healthcare than I. A government would need to decide to spend considerably more money. Double primary care because we need two times more family doctors, and all of these technologies are more and more expensive than they were in the past. So it's a huge investment. We need a lot more tax dollars. The first step, though, is to create a system. And it can be 100% public system. But when you create a system, then you're able to count things. You can know where the pressure points are. You can understand what is going to happen if you allow private MRIs and not private surgeries. You're going to have a million more MRIs and people needing surgery, and the backlog for surgery is going to expand. We prevent huge wait lists for surgery by preventing the diagnostic imaging. When I went to Buffalo myself, it was only $400, but I went because I didn't need it. I could have gotten it here. I could have, I've got lots of connections as well, but I knew that my pain was not something that was going to be surgically operable. I just wanted to know. So mm-hmm. It was a nice to have, not a need to have. And I think that's the real problem with private medicine, is that it creates a market for health services that people do not need, but that they want. And mm-hmm. those are very expensive. It creates an insurance market. It creates upselling. The idea that it won't be more expensive for all of us as a society, you know, just like the idea that it'll be continue to be equitable, is just implausible and nonsense. We may want to go there, but we can't lie to ourselves.
Dr. Barry Pakis, Dr. Elisa Naiman, Dr. Malcolm Moore, thank you all so much. And Dr. Moore, thank you for bringing this editorial to our attention so we could have this important and what should always be a respectful conversation. Thank you to you all.
Thank you.
All right. It is Jane for Libby. And still to come in the next segment of Fight Back, are you fighting back against the proposed Billy Bishop Airport expansion? Or is it time to fly jets in and out of the island airport with an extended runway? Waiting on your calls, 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
What happens at Billy Bishop Airport on Toronto's island affects all of us who live and work in Toronto, not just those close to the waterfront. That is my belief. We're currently being asked by the federal Liberals in Ottawa to fill out an online survey and provide our thoughts and reaction to an expanded island airport, which would include a longer runway to allow for jets. So I filled out the survey, and honestly, I thought it was very poorly thought out. I mean, it asks me, and it'll ask you too, your suggestions on how the airport might be expanded. What they should have done, my opinion, is provide us with scenarios that we can agree or disagree with, provided by experts. The survey period ends on July 24th, 1 month from today, so you still have time to complete it. You can also send an email or a regular piece of mail to react further once you've filled out the survey. And it is easy to find. Just search Billy Bishop Airport Expansion Consultation. Joining me to provide us with more information and an update, Norm DePasquale, Chair of No Jets TO. Norm, thank you. You've been at this a long time.
Thank you, Jane. That's totally true. It's been a solid 12 years now.
Wow, yeah. Well, we've yet to receive anything official on the proposed island airport expansion. Is that right?
Yeah, we really have received no plan. And it's interesting finding ourselves in the context of this consultation without a plan or a business case. So, you know, it's an interesting time.
I mean, there is a plan because Mayor Chow and her staff said that they were asked to sign an NDA to find out about the proposal, and they all refused to do so, saying that the process should be transparent. Your thoughts on that?
I completely agree with Mayor Chow. Like, Torontonians are being shut out of this debate with, Mayor Ford taking the city's role in the Island Airport Agreement. It should be transparent. Now, probably it's like some high-level consultant report that lays out a couple of things. I don't think it's the full plan that they have ready at this point.
Just based on your closeness to the topic, what do you think the proposal looks like in terms of indications you've been given?
Yeah, so we know some things, like the runway is going to be 900 meters longer, which is taller than the Burj Khalifa in terms of distance. We know some things from the environmental assessment that was done back in 2017 about the last jet proposal, that you would have debilitating traffic. Traffic would be worse by 450% in that neighborhood. And our harbor would take twice the amount of time to flush sewage out of it if this expansion was to go forward.
And the jets. Talk to us about the jets.
Yeah, and, the environment's assessment from 2017 called for a jet every 2.5 minutes on our waterfront. So turning our central harbor front into Pearson on the lake.
And what is it now? What is the time between planes landing now and taking off?
I mean, you could go, let's say, 5 to 10 minutes in between. Sometimes a bit longer. It just, jets are quite a bit larger. So, you know, you're thinking about like a Boeing 737 size jet landing once every 2.5 minutes on our waterfront with all of the noise, fumes, kind of impact on all the other activities that would have.
Okay. So, you know, we know that legislation has passed at Queen's Park by the Ford PCs, the majority Ford PCs, who will be in government for the next almost 4 years at least, and maybe longer if they win another election. In terms of the motivation, as far as I know, and I'm in the news business, prior to this push for an expanded Billy Bishop Airport, nobody was really talking about it. So where is it all coming from?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, there's a couple of theories there. Like Ford got, you know, was very interested in buying like a gravy plane jet at the time, and that could only land at Billy Bishop if the runway was expanded. The other possibility is this came from the new federal government, and they're kind of using Ford as kind of a front man for this. And I'm happy to see that federal survey, because it's really the federal government that are the decision maker on whether jets fly at the Island Airport or not. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad to see they're taking at least a bit of responsibility for that key role that they play in this decision.
Right. And we're getting very little feedback, and maybe rightly so, from Prime Minister Mark Carney and his cabinet ministers until they can assess all of the results from the survey, correct?
Yeah, like I view the survey as kind of a temperature check. You know, if we're loud enough right now and we say no jets, we may be able to end this thing at the end of the consultation. And I have noticed that even Prime Minister Mark Carney's language is changing. Like he was first calling this kind of an interesting vision, and then he moved over to, I have no opinion whatsoever on this subject. So I'm seeing that pressure is working, and statements from all the way from the Prime Minister to your local Member of Parliament are improving as we, you know, as constituents reach out and you know, share their two cents.
And what do you think about the survey? You heard I was not impressed by it, but what did you think?
I'm in exactly the same boat as you, Jane. You know, this survey seems like it was put together in a rush. And, you know, the questions almost look like a push pull where it's like, would you support the airport becoming more modern? Or how would you fix issues after we, you know, blindly added jets to the Island Airport here? So this is thin gruel, and I would say it's a temperature check. And but I still, with that said, I think it's super important for everybody to fill out that survey. If you go to nojetsto.com, we have a blog helping you through how to fill out that survey well. And I think it's important for everyone to have their two cents up to July 24th.
And really important for everyone, right? Even if you don't work or live by the harbor.
Yeah, like this can affect housing plans. We might lose tens of thousands of housing units to jet safety areas. In South Etobicoke, your windows might have to be forced shut and balconies eliminated, you know, because it's part of a jet flight path. So you'd have a jet going over every 2.5 minutes. Now your housing is going to change in South Etobicoke. It's going to change in Eastern Waterfront. And, you know, traffic as well affects us all.
And
this is our waterfront.
And
you know,
right. And let's think about this from a practical point of view. I mean, Pearson Airport is constantly expanding. We have three terminals now. Maybe there will be another one. It seems to handle international traffic well. Being a pretty regular traveler in and out of Pearson Airport, that's my observation. And we have the UP Express, right? So you can pretty much get out to the airport, even if you don't have a car, by getting to a stop on the UP Express. So it's not like the days when you had to take a cab from Union Station or somewhere in the city.
Yeah, that's right. Like a lot has changed since the last jet proposal back in 2014. We have the UP Express that gets you to Pearson in 28 minutes from Union. We have a revitalized waterfront that we've invested billions in, and it's given us billions more back. There's no sense in putting that at risk for this, you know, redundant jet airport.
And the other thing, too, with Doug Ford's grand plans for Ontario Place, does he really want jets landing and taking off every 2 minutes in a brand new water park or, you know, Ontario Park?
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe it. We've invested billions in the revitalization of Ontario Place, and there's going to be jets taking off and landing. You could throw a rock from Trillium Park to where those jets will be taking off and landing. It is going to be, it's going to go from serenity to deafening noise at Ontario Place. And I can't imagine any visitor would want that.
I'm not sure, you know, I threw out the phone numbers there a few minutes ago. We're not getting calls about this. I don't know if it's not resonating with people because they think, oh, it'll never happen. You know, it's one of those pie in the sky things that Doug Ford is talking about. I'm wondering if people are taking it seriously and understanding that their feedback, even though this online survey is kind of bogus, but that feedback is going to the Canadian government, which ultimately makes the final say.
Yeah, you hit it right on the head. The federal government is the key decision maker here. And our campaign has seen incredible momentum. We have 2,500 lawn signs out throughout the city of Toronto now. And, you know, tons of volunteers and people signing up. People are really concerned about this. And, you know, we're at least seeing it there. And maybe people are getting ready for the Canada soccer game.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's true. That's true. And you know, the other thing, too, I was just thinking about in terms of the future. Doug Ford's already talking about shovels in the ground, like it is happening. But I think it is important for people to realize that it is not happening, even though he says it is.
Yeah, the federal government, your member of parliament, these are the key decision makers. If the federal government says no, this whole thing ends. Back in 2015, the federal transport minister, Mark Arnault, sent a tweet saying no jets. That ended the entire debate a decade ago, and they can do the same right now.
Okay, now the phone lines are ringing. As soon as I say nobody seems to care, people do care. Kathy in Etobicoke, what are your thoughts about an expanded island airport?
No, absolutely not. They're doing a lot of work. They've spent a lot of money to make the waterfront nicer. Bringing more jets into the airport is absolute nonsense. They had the Pickering Airport, which they didn't do anything with. They should have. Why not open that back up?
All right, Kathy, thank you for your opinion. Yvonne, you're calling in on the Island Airport expansion. Go ahead.
Hi, yes, I'm calling in from Mississauga. And I frequent the downtown core enough times to see the Toronto Blue Jays play, as well as enjoy the rest of the harbor front. I am completely against the expansion of the island airport. And as a very good analogy, living here in Mississauga around the Streetsville area, we had have just recently commented on the fact that the number of jets flying over our house, which at the time we purchased 30 years ago was next to hardly any, but over those 30 years, there was an expansion of both the Britannia and the Derry Road runways. I think they actually built two parallel runways to both of those current old ones. So now we have one that I call the Thomas Street runway. And as a result, the jets are flying over our backyard every 2.5 to 3 minutes.
Oh, that's got to be annoying. Yep.
My husband commented on Sunday as we were sitting on our deck, a very old deck, which needs to be rebuilt, and looked at me and said, you know, with those jets flying over, it makes me not want to spend the money on putting a deck in our backyard again because it is not enjoyable. And he got up and took his dinner plate and went inside.
Well, that makes the point. Yeah, that makes the point right there. Yvonne, thank you so much for your passionate phone call and your opinion. Norm, we've got to go. I really appreciate the conversation, and we will have it again sometime soon, I'm sure.
Thanks, Jane. It was a pleasure.
Norm DePasquale, chair of No Jets. Tia, wow, we could keep going on that one. And if you want to add your comment on Free for All Friday, please do. Tasha Carradine will be here for Libby. But coming up in the final segment of Fight Back, why won't Toronto City Councillors, respond to a growing demand for resumed vehicle access to Hyde Park 7 days a week? We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
I want to be clear right away before we get into this segment that our viewpoint here at Zoomer Radio is to allow vehicles back in Toronto's Hyde Park every day, not just on weekdays. We believe all people should have access to the park on all days because not everyone is able-bodied and not everyone can haul sports equipment into and out of the park by foot. We also believe that the 20 kilometer an hour speed limit should be enforced, which is not the case when professional cyclists use the park as a racing track. So we are on side with the group High Park Access, whose volunteer members have launched a new website at highparkaccess.com. What are your thoughts? 416-360-0740 or 1-866-744-740. And you can text us at 866-744-740. What's important to note in all of this is the lack of reaction from city councillors to what has been a growing issue in Toronto. With their insights, I'm joined by Karen Stintz, former Toronto City Councillor and good friend to Fight Back, and Daniel Tate, Executive Director of Integrity TO, quickly becoming a regular guest on Fight Back as well. Hello to you both.
Hi, Jane. Hey, Daniel.
Hi, Jane. Good afternoon.
Understanding neither of you is on City Council now, what do you feel, what do you think is the reticence to hearing out the High Park Access Group, Karen?
It is a bit unusual that such a large group would not get an audience with their city councillor, but it, I think, all stems from what we've been talking about, this theme that is pervasive in the city, that if you just block cars or make it too hard for cars to get around, that somehow you're building a safer city. And at some point, that logic doesn't hold. And we're seeing it in that, you know, maybe we're building a city without cars, but we're also not building a city that people want to live in. Because if you can't go to the park, for goodness sakes, like, what are we doing?
Right. And the irony here, Daniel, is that drivers of vehicles observe the 20 kilometer an hour speed limit, whereas professional cyclists don't.
Yeah, it's completely ludicrous. In my view, what you have here is a city councillor, Gord Perks, who completely capitulated to the cycling lobby at the expense of practically everybody else who needs to access the park with their vehicle for various reasons. And what was supposed to be just a short thing during COVID, you know, this was the social distancing era, so they had to block parks. You know, we remember the craziness of that time, but that was supposed to be short-lived. And when COVID was over, we were supposed to get back to normal, and we never did. And, you know, people like Gord Perks, again, just caved to the cycling lobby. And here we are several years later having to talk about this.
Right. And the volunteers with this High Park Access group, they were High Park Access for All. They've just tightened it up to High Park Access. Their philosophy on all of this is that, you know, responsible vehicle owners will continue to do what they have done all along, and that is observe the speed limit, visit the park more often. As a result, Karen, we have far fewer visitors in the park than we did before these restrictions were put in place.
And I'm not surprised because, again, a family is not going to go into the park if they have to park, find a place, you know, just the logistics of it, find a place to park around the park and then go catch a shuttle to go into the park. It doesn't make any sense.
No.
And, you know, even if you're, you know, walking your dog to the off-leash area or, to your point, bringing in sports equipment, like, the shuttle is an inadequate response because you still have to find a place to park your car and then get to the shuttle. And so it just creates more, you know, congestion around the park. And it all comes down to why. And if it's all about achieving environmental goals by not allowing cars into parks, well, that's at the expense of people's enjoyment of the park and the use of the park and supporting the other ancillary things that happen in that park. And so you can't just hold out this one goal. And, you know, and even if that were the goal to be held up amongst all others, we don't achieve our CO2 emissions by closing High Park to cars, right?
Right. And vehicle emissions are not what they once were. I mean, cars
are not spewing
smoke unless they have, you know, they haven't had an oil change in a year or whatever.
Correct. And I do think that there is some credence to the fact that the, you know, the cycling lobby was able to you know, be successful in this endeavor, because the reality is they don't want people in the park, so they can go more than 20 kilometers an hour. And so, but that's not what the park is for. And so if we go back to first principles, what is a park for? It's for the common use and enjoyment of the people who live in the city. And in order to facilitate that use, people need to be able to access it. And there's already roads there. There's already designated parking spots for people with disabilities. There's already like places for cars to be able to access the park, because it was intended, that access was intended. And so I think that this is a mistake. And if Gord Perks was running again, maybe he would give more audience to those that are mounting a campaign against it, but he's not. So I guess he doesn't care.
Yeah, he doesn't care at this point. And we'll see who replaces him on October 26th. I have a text here saying, I'm totally behind the efforts of reestablishing cars and bicycles in High Park. Well, bicycles are allowed in High Park. It's the cars on weekends. We've done it before. It's not impossible. Thank you for keeping it on the front line. And Daniel, really, it's only a matter of time, and I hate to even say it, before somebody is injured by one of these cyclists going 50, 60 miles an hour.
Yeah, High Park has basically become a velodrome for cyclists. I've been there a few times. It's like the Tour de France. They've completely taken over the park, and that is not right. That's not what the park was designed for. We can build a custom velodrome somewhere for the cyclists, but you know, I have a message for the Toronto Police. Actually, you want to do a great blitz? Go do a radar trap for the cyclists at High Park, and there'll be a ton of tickets for you to issue. That is a big problem. Nobody at City Council is talking about it. Perks, he's already checked out. He's retiring. So I think we're going to need some moral clarity for the new from the new candidates who are running to represent Ward 4, Parkdale High Park.
Right. That needs to be an issue in this municipal election, which is underway. Sorry, I said 50 or 60 miles an hour. 50 or 60 kilometers an hour.
Yeah.
I was thinking in the imperial system there for just a moment. So, and what do you think about that, Karen? I mean, we do have to go, but like making this an election issue in High Park, Parkdale.
I think it is an election issue, and not just for High Park, because we have the closure of Church Street. We have a motion in front of council to close other streets without proper process. So I actually think it escalates to something across the city around, you know, what does it mean to have public spaces that we now can't access and roads we can't drive on?
Okay, I love that Tour de France comment, Daniel. Thank you both so much for your comments today. It is an ongoing conversation. Thank you both.
Take care.
Thank you, Jane.
Daniel Tate, Executive Director of Integrity TO, and Karen Stintz, a former Toronto City Councillor and regular Fight Back panelist. Jane for Libby, Tasha Carradine is in tomorrow with our Municipal Tune Into the Town panel, and then Free for All Friday on Friday to wrap up the week. Have a good day. Go Canada at 3 o'clock, and I'll talk to you tomorrow morning on the Morning Zoom with Andy and Jane.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.